Hey folks, and welcome back to the Theopolis Podcast. I'm your host, Brian Motz, and I'm the content manager at Theopolis Institute. Theopolis trains men and women to lead cultural renewal by renewing the church. Participants in our programs learn to read the Bible imaginatively, worship God faithfully, and engage the culture intelligently. In this episode, we are continuing on in our series in the Book of Acts, and here Peter Lighthart, Alistair Roberts, Jeffrey Myers, and James B. John are going to be discussing Stephen's speech before his martyrdom in Acts chapter 7. We are at the beginning of our year-end fundraising campaign for Theopolis. Peter Lighthart's going to discuss a little bit of that at the top of this episode. But if you would like to become a donor and give to our work, which supports things like this podcast, our weekly articles and videos, and our courses and conferences throughout the year, you can find a link in the show notes to our give page. We are very thankful already for you listening and for your prayers. And if you are able to give something as a one-time gift or a monthly gift, we want to thank you for that as well. During his opening remarks, Peter Lighthart also discusses our upcoming Psalter project, which we are very excited about. If you'd like to hear examples of some of the psalm chants that we've already produced, I've linked all of them in the show notes for you. Again, we want to thank you for listening. We hope that you enjoy this discussion. And here are Peter Lighthart, Alistair Roberts, Jeffrey Myers, and James B. John discussing Stephen's speech in Acts chapter 7.
Welcome to the Theopolis Podcast. I'm Peter Lighthart, and I'm here today with Alistair Roberts, James B. John, and Jeff Myers. Brian Motz, as usual, is in the background recording, and he'll be editing and making sure that this podcast recording is fit for public consumption. We are entering our mid-year fundraising drive in the next few weeks. We run as our fiscal year from July 1 to the end of June on an academic cycle. And that means that we do some fundraising in the middle of the year. Toward the end of June and the beginning of July, we're going to be doing that during the course of July. And I just wanted to give one small plug for Theopolis. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, we encourage you to think about becoming a donor if you aren't at this point a donor. You can get on our website, theopolisinstitute.com, and click on the Give link, and that'll take you to a page where you can enter a certain amount to donate something to Theopolis. We know that many people are suffering economically during the pandemic and during the shutdown. We realize that it's a hardship on many, and we're very grateful for all those of you who support us. And we do ask you, if you aren't supporting us and you're able to begin supporting us. The focal point of our fundraising is going to be the work that we're completing on the first stage of our Psalter project. For years, we've hoped to put together a complete Psalter using Jim Jordan's psalm translations and the psalm settings that he began to put together. We're completing in the last stages of putting together a first edition of that Theopolis liturgy and Psalter. It includes about 40 psalms, and this is the first stage of something we hope will eventually become a full Psalter. We're assembling a team, and we're laying out a plan over the next few years to try to complete the translations. Jim Jordan translated most of the psalms, but there are some that need to be translated. They need to be pointed for chanting, and then we need to have composers put together chant tunes and then get that published and available to the public. The first edition that we're putting out soon is the first stage of that. We're very excited by the first edition, but we're really looking forward to the longer-term project of putting out a Psalter. If you particularly want to contribute to that, if you've seen our psalm videos where Brian Motz sometimes is singing solo, singing Jim Jordan's psalm translations to Jim Jordan's psalm chant settings, or we've had groups do that. We had our fellows do some recording. If you've enjoyed those, then you get a flavor of what this Psalter is going to be like and what it would sound like if you were singing it with the congregation. And I encourage you, if you haven't listened to those, go to our YouTube page and listen to several of those psalm chants, because they came out very well. They're lovely chants. Brian sings very well, and our fellows sing very well. So that'll give you a taste of what we're trying to do. So if you're donating to Theopolis, you're donating, among many other things, to the podcast, to our website, to our courses, but you're also donating to that Psalter project that we are beginning and will be working on for the next several years. So again, we're grateful for your support, and we thank you for praying for us, and we thank you for your financial support. We're in the middle of a series of studies in the podcast on the Book of Acts. We began this a couple of months ago, and we have come to Acts 7. We're going to take a couple of episodes of the podcast to talk about Acts 7 because it's a very long chapter and also crucial chapter in the book of Acts, or if you want to think about Luke and Acts together as a single two-volume work, Acts 7 is a crucial turning point in the plot. I believe I pointed this out at the time when we started the series in Acts, but you have a shift in the geographical trajectory from the book of Luke to the book of Acts. In Luke, everything's moving toward Jerusalem. The opening narratives in the first two chapters move to Jerusalem. Jesus goes on a long journey to Jerusalem in the middle of the book. At the end of the book, the apostles are still in Jerusalem waiting for the coming of the Spirit, the power that Jesus has promised to send them from on high. And at the beginning of the book of Acts, they're still in Jerusalem. The first six chapters that we've been examining over the last couple of months are all taking place in Jerusalem. But we know from the beginning of Acts that the story is going to go further than Jerusalem. It's going to go to Judea and to Samaria and to the uttermost parts of the earth. So at some point, we know from the first chapter of Acts that that trajectory, that movement toward Jerusalem is going to shift, and there's going to be a movement out of Jerusalem to eventually to Rome. And Acts 7 is when that happens. People begin to move out of Jerusalem, and the story shifts its focus from Jerusalem to Antioch and then to Paul's missionary journeys, ultimately to Rome. The story often comes back to Jerusalem, but it's no longer the exclusive focal point as it has been in the early chapters. And the thing that sparks that movement, the thing that spreads the church out in mission, is the death of Stephen. The first martyr who sheds his blood in union with Jesus is the foundation of the mission of the church in the way that Luke Acts is put together. So in the broad picture, Luke, chapter 7 is crucial to the movement of Luke and Acts. And I think it's also important, we talked about Acts 6 last time. Stephen was introduced. Stephen was accused of speaking against the law and against this place, against the holy place, the temple. False witnesses are brought forward as they were brought forward in the trial of Jesus. And what we have in Acts 7 follows immediately on that. We're still in the trial scene, and Acts 7 is Stephen's defense, as it were, at this trial. He responds to some of the charges that are brought, but he goes much further than that, and there's a lot more going on in chapter 7 than simply a response to the trial. But at least we do have that happening.
Perhaps just a quick question on that, Peter, or others, in terms of the backdrop to this. So in verse 13 of chapter 6, for instance, the accusation comes, and as you say, it's false witnesses, and they say that we've heard him say that Jesus will destroy this place and change the customs which Moses delivered to us. I wondered what people thought about these are false witnesses, but these are the sort of conversations that might have been going along in the early church at that stage. Certainly Jesus had spoke about the destruction of the temple in the seeds of what Jesus says about how a man becomes unclean. There was the sense in which it's not foods that do that ultimately, but it's the heart. And so I just wondered, I don't imagine these accusations came out of nowhere while they're false. So I wonder to what extent you thought these were things that were being discussed at the time in the church.
That has to be the case. Like you said, James, Jesus has talked about the destruction of the temple in his Olivet Discourse, and surely they were conversing about those things. And also, Stephen, toward the end of this, in fact, it's one of the highlights, the climaxes of his speech, talks about how they have misused the temple and basically made it into a pagan temple. Verse 48, the Most High does not dwell in houses made by hands. So there is surely among the apostles and in the early church a polemic against the Jews and the place where they're worshiping.
I guess I would add a qualification to that. I think that's right, Jeff. But the point you made about the way Stephen describes the Jewish leaders and their attitude toward the temple, their use of the temple, they're using it in an idolatrous way. He connects it with the golden calf incident. There's a continuity between the golden calf incident and the way that the Jewish leaders are regarding the temple. They believe that they've kind of captured God in his house, and God is at their command. So what they're speaking against, it's not the institution of the temple per se, but it's the corruption of God's good gift of the temple by the Jewish leaders and by their idolatry.
We might maybe think of Jeremiah 7 and other passages like that in the background, the appeal to the temple of the Lord as such, and then the way that the temple of the Lord, certainly in Jesus' challenge to it, he highlights that passage. It has become a den of robbers, somewhere that they return to claim immunity from all their sins, rather than actually a place of encounter with the living God.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I think prophecies like Jeremiah are very much in the background. The other movement that I wanted to highlight in just looking at how Acts 7 fits into the flow of the book, we've mentioned this a number of times, that very early on, the apostles are opposed by the Jews, and there's this contest between the Jewish leaders and the apostles over the leadership of Israel, who's going to be setting the trajectory and the future for the people of God. And there's been an escalating clash. Initially, there's a warning given. Then the apostles are beaten along with a warning. But this takes that escalation a step further, because now for the first time we have one of the disciples of Jesus killed because of his witness. So that we have that intensifying conflict that ends up with this explosion, not only the death of Stephen, but then Saul immediately begins persecuting on a wide scale. And that pressure builds up, and then it explodes and people scatter from Jerusalem.
Back to James's comment, and noticing in verse 1, the high priest asks Stephen a question, "Are these things so?" And Stephen doesn't respond with a simple denial. He really couldn't do that. Nor does he reply with a simple gospel presentation. He gives this very long speech. It's 60 verses. And I think word count wise, it's longer than any sermon or speech by St. Paul in Acts. And here is Luke, you know, St. Paul's assistant, recording this. So it has some serious significance in the story of the early church and in the progression of what's going on here for Luke, and should be for us also. And so the question is, why is this speech so important that Luke has to record it all here? What's the point? What's it doing here?
And I guess relatedly, why does Stephen pick out the particular incidents which he does pick out? As I was looking over this, it struck me as fairly clear as to why Stephen might draw attention to Joseph and Moses. Here were messianic figures who were, at least initially, rejected by their people and who actually thrived in Gentile situations. And this will have very direct application to the life of Jesus and his popularity among the Gentiles. But it wasn't as clear to me why and what purpose Stephen has in going back to Abraham and Abraham's call in verse 2 at the start of this speech. So I'd be interested to hear views on that.
I think what you're getting here is, beginning with Abraham, a account of the separation of these messengers from their kindred. Abraham has to leave. Abraham goes to a new land. And in each case that Stephen references here, the messengers and deliverers sent by God to them by the God of glory, they have to distance themselves from their kindred. And that's the case with Abraham. That's the case with Joseph. And that's the case with Moses. And Stephen calls attention to the fact that Israel initially spurned Moses, even though he was attempting to deliver them. And even after he delivered them, in fact, through the Red Sea, we have the golden calf incidents. And then the prophets are all mocked and rejected. So I think that's one of the underlying themes in this story, is what Stephen is doing is telling the Israelite leaders that they're not really getting the story of Israel right if they don't understand what's happening right now with the remnant believers in the Christian church.
Also see it as beginning the story of Israel with a story of promise. And the story of Israel begins with a promise, and it begins promisingly, and yet it goes wrong. There's this series of rejections that follow. But there are three aspects to that promise which any of the Jews who were listening to Stephen would have resonated with. There's the promise of the land, there's the promise of deliverance from slavery, and then there's the promise that they would worship at that particular place. And what Stephen does here, among other things, is set up a common foundation in the story. They agree with it to this point, and it gives him a bit more traction later on for his argument as he shows exactly how a Christian reading of Israel's history diverts from a Jewish one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the things that are promised to Abraham at the beginning of the speech are lost or perverted by the Jews. That's the accusation. And I think the other thing that's turning on that is the whole rhetorical force of the speech. It's formally a defense because he's been accused, Stephen has, and Stephen's defending himself. But like the other apostolic sermons so far in the book of Acts, it's actually a speech of accusation against the Jews. The apostles have been accusing the Jews of putting Jesus to death and abandoning him, and Stephen picks up on some of that language, but he puts it in a much larger context. And instead of defending himself against the accusations, he turns the accusations against the Jews that they've abandoned everything that was promised Abraham and become really an anti-Abrahamic people rather than an Abrahamic people.
So did you notice that Stephen, at the end of Acts 6, before the council, they see him, his face was like the face of an angel. And then in this story, in his speech, four times he references angels. In fact, he ends on that note in verse 53, "You who have received the law as delivered by angels did not keep it." So that Stephen himself is an angel, a messenger, and he refers to all the times in which the Israelites refused their messengers, whether it's Joseph or Moses, or even just angels. In verse 30, when 40 years had passed, an angel appeared to him in the wilderness. So in one sense, Stephen is one of the last angels, and we know that Israel, of course, was guarded by and led by angelic mediators and guardians. Stephen is one of the last in giving them an opportunity to repent of their sin of killing the righteous one.
That emphasis, which you brought out earlier, Jeff, about how Abraham had to leave where he was and abandon, I guess, the possessions and his inheritance and so on, that would resonate with and explain, I guess, why Stephen brings out this detail that the God of glory appeared to our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia. I guess that would emphasize that it was kind of not once he'd already left along with Terah, but it was while he was in the situation into which he was born that God first appeared to him and called him to leave. That can be got, I think, from a close and careful reading of the Old Testament. But Stephen brings it out here, I think. It makes his point very well.
I think the more general point in reference to Jeff's comments is that Stephen is telling the story of Israel in a way that has connections with the circumstance that he himself is in. So leaving your father's house, and that's what the apostles will eventually do. They'll be moving out from Israel into journeying towards some kind of new land. We also have that when Stephen gets to talking about Joseph. Joseph's brothers were jealous of him. Verse 9, the patriarchs became jealous of Joseph and sold him into Egypt, yet God was with him. That's already been brought up earlier in Acts as the attitude of the Jewish leaders toward the apostles, and earlier the attitude of the Jewish leaders toward Jesus himself. So by putting in these, he puts phrases in that link up with the circumstances and experience of the apostles and sticks that into Israel's history. That kind of slots everyone in a role. Joseph is put in the role of the one who is the object of jealousy, Jesus and the apostles. On the other hand, the Jewish leaders are put in the role of the brothers who betray their brother and sell him into slavery. So there's an ongoing link up with his immediate circumstances.
We can think about the way that we tell the story of our nations more generally, and a slight change in the way that a story is told can completely shift the tenor of the story. So, for instance, you can tell the story of America in a way that focuses upon the work of the founders, or you can focus upon 1619 in the recent project in the New York Times, or maybe the movement from Seneca Falls to Selma to Stonewall. It's another way of telling the story. And we're having the same thing here within the New Testament. So much of what's going on beneath the surface is a retelling of Israel's story. The same key events are present within the story, but different aspects of them are being foregrounded, different connections between them are being drawn, and a different path is being forged from them into the present. And whereas in the New Testament it's implicit in the background, here it comes very much to the foreground. This is a clear telling of the whole story in a way that shows how the church saw itself fitting into it.
Yeah, good point. I think that there's another dimension to this part that fits into the struggle between the apostles and the Jewish leaders over the loyalty of Israel. You could describe that in terms of the question of who's going to be elevated as judges and rulers over Israel. Jesus promised that the apostles would. They're going to sit on 12 thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And I think that's part of what's in the background of Stephen's telling of certain parts of the story. I'm thinking again of the account he gives of Joseph. The patriarchs become jealous of Joseph and sold him into Egypt. And we know that the Jewish leaders have been jealous of the apostles. But then verse 10 goes on to tell the further, God rescued him from all his afflictions and granted Joseph favor and wisdom in the sight of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he made him governor over Egypt and over all his household. So the one who's being despised by the brothers is the one who's eventually elevated and given favor by Pharaoh. And that's, as Jeff has pointed out in teaching on Acts in various contexts, that's a movement that we find in a number of stories in Paul's ministry, for example, where you have characters who are opposed to Paul, but at the end of the episode, Paul is elevated to take their place as an advisor to the king. And again, I think Stephen sees that dynamic going on in the story of Joseph, but also applying it now to the experience of the apostles.
Another dynamic going on at the same time, I think, Peter, in those texts, is the distinction between how the Jews are viewing someone and how God and or the church community or the Gentile community, in fact, is viewing them. So here in verse 10, for instance, you mentioned that Joseph has been rejected by his brethren, but he is granted favor and is viewed as wise and is exalted by Pharaoh. And then we get the same thing in verse 20 of the same chapter. Moses has been disregarded or will be, but it said he was beautiful in God's sight. And we can see this, as you've said, Peter, reflecting Stephen's own situation. He is here speaking because he's been chosen out specifically in order to represent various people in the Christian community. He's a man of high standing, and yet now he has very low standing in the eyes of the authorities. And obviously the example par excellence, I guess, is Jesus himself, who by God is viewed as the holy, the righteous one, and yet has been rejected by the Jewish people. So this seems to be a theme going on. But as I say, particularly relevant seems to be the fact that in the eyes of the Gentiles, these people, Moses and Joseph, seem to be gaining standing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Verse 9, that word jealous is the word zealous, zelao. So that you could translate that, the patriarchs zealous of Joseph, or zealous with regard to Joseph. One of the things that comes out in the book of Acts is that the Jews had basically turned into zealots. That word is used again in chapter 17:5, when Paul is in Thessalonica and the Jews become zealots, and I think that's where they enlist the rabble in order to pursue Paul. So this theme of zealotry, that the Jews have become envious and hateful and aggressive toward Paul, is a big deal. And I'll also call attention to the fact that there's a lesson here in the book of Acts. The hatred, the persecution, the violence against Stephen or the church or against Paul always comes from those who we might think would be most receptive, their brethren. Mm-hmm. The Jews, and a point that I continually make, and I'll just keep making it, the Romans aren't the enemy here. The pagans aren't the real problem. It's their kindred. It's their comrades. It's their people. And there's a huge lesson for us here. And sometimes what happens is we get really disappointed and hurt about this, but look, no one is more vicious or hateful in their speech, and often more dead set on destroying Christians than fellow church members. And social media brings this out. It is shocking how vicious and jealous and envious and hateful other Christians can be toward other Christians, even things that, of course, okay, you're wrong about this, or we believe you're wrong about this. But then instead of just trying to have a reasonable argument, which apparently you can't have on any of these social media sites, it ends up becoming an awful mess of just hateful speech. I mean, we've seen this with the Amy Bird controversy on the Geneva Commons Facebook group. Whatever we think of Amy Bird and her positions, I'm not particularly in favor of them. Wow, can't we just have a logical kind of biblical-based argument about these things and not revert to name-calling?
Yeah, I think it's important. The point you made, Jeff, I think you were making, was that social media amplifies it and makes it public, but it's amplifying things that go on in churches all the time anyway, in private, that we wouldn't see apart from the availability of social media. But it's not like you were having an entirely peaceful experience as a pastor up until whenever Twitter started or Facebook was launched. It's just that it wasn't out in front of the world all the time.
Right. But it also highlights the fact that it's often, too often, more often than we'd like to actually believe, that it's other Christians who end up being enemies and envious and all the rest. And that's something that's coming out in Acts 7, and it's going to come out all through the book of Acts, is Paul's problem comes from his fellows, what he hoped to be comrades, the Jews.
We also see here, I think, the way in which the early church was already reading the Old Testament in the light of Christ. At the end of Luke, there is Christ opening their eyes to understand the scriptures and teaching them concerning himself in all the scriptures, in the law, the prophets, and the Psalms. And in characters like Joseph, I think we're seeing something of what they would have seen in the book of Matthew, the 11 brothers go to Christ and bow down to him and worship him. And you think the story of Joseph behind that, mm-hmm. or the way in which Joseph is sold for silver and his brother Judah being involved, Judas, his part that he plays, the two criminals associated, all these sorts of details would have invited a Christological reading of the story of Joseph. And then there's that second stage that has opened up. He's been elevated to the authority of the right hand of the power, and now he calls for people to repent. And so there's a very natural way in which that could be read. Mm-hmm. One interesting detail I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on are some of the unusual details that we have here. For instance, in the story of Joseph and Jacob, there is an elision of certain details. So there is a burial place bought in chapter 23 of Genesis, the Cave of Machpelah. And then there's also the
tract of land that's purchased from the Shechemites in chapter 33, I think it is. And they're described as if a single event. And then the burial there, we know that Jacob's burial was in the Cave of Machpelah near Hebron. But Joseph's burial at the very end of the book of Joshua is in the Shechem area. So I wonder what we're to make of these sorts of details, because I don't think they're impossible to harmonize, but they're unusual. And for that reason, I think they invite our investigation and attention.
Yeah, I mean, there will be a theological purpose, I guess, to the whole thing. If I could just comment on the literary device behind it, it seems that what is going on is a kind of telescoping, perhaps, or an attributing what's happening to an earlier ancestor and seeing them in the background. So I guess verse 16 here, they were carried back to Shechem and laid in the tomb which Abraham had bought for a sum of silver from the sons of Hamor. It's Jacob who actually did that, who actually made that purchase. But we have precedent for this in Luke's own text. So at the start, in Acts 1, for instance, it is said that Judas bought a field, but we know from Matthew's gospel, actually what he did was throw the silver down and then the priests bought it on his behalf. But that is credited that by Luke that Judas bought that field. And so I think what we're seeing here, in some passages at least, is Luke is using that as a consistent device. This is not incompetence on his behalf. It's a way in which he writes.
And could you, James, go further with that and say that in the way that Stephen is telling the story, the land is promised to Abraham. It includes the promise that the land will be inherited after 400 years. But the claim on the land that later descendants of Abraham get is still the fulfillment of that promise. And so in some extended sense, there's it's Abraham inheriting the land, even though it's literally his descendants, but it's still fulfillment of that promise. Does that fit into the way you were thinking about it? That might give a theological basis for that, for Luke's, at least in this case, Luke's literary technique or historical technique?
Yeah, I think that sounds right to me. Yeah, so I've put across like the literary device, and then I think you're spot on in terms of like the theological import of it.
We could also maybe think about the parallel between the beginning of the story of Joseph as it's recounted here, and then the end. The beginning, he's sent from Hebron to Shechem to visit his brothers. And it's at Shechem, he's sent from there to Dothan, and then he's rejected, sold, and brought down into Egypt. And then at the end, there is another act of selling, the selling of the field, and then there's a return to Shechem. And it is the story of the Exodus itself. The story of the Exodus is first hinted at, Abraham, when he's in the death, as it were, of the deep sleep. But at the very end of the book of Genesis, we're told that they will return from that land and they will bring up Jacob's bones with them, and or Joseph's bones with them. And at the very end of the book of Joshua, the bones of Joseph are laid to rest. And it seems that there's a symmetry there. And it suggests also something about the place that Joseph has. It's not until they go down and retrieve the brother and the leader that they have rejected that they will actually inherit the land. And so that great place of inheritance is when they actually enter into the land. It's when they actually return their brother, the brother that they have sold.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Well, another detail that I was puzzling over thinking about was the highlighting of the first and the second visit. Verses 12 and 13, Jacob heard there was grain in Egypt. He sent our fathers there the first time. The second, Joseph made himself known. We'll talk about this in the next episode, but there's a similar kind of first and second structure in the way that Stephen tells the story of Moses. And I don't want to steal our thunder for next time, but I think that that's he's drawing out a Christological reading of life of Moses there in that double coming. But I wondered if there's some anticipation of that in the first and second visit to Joseph. It's not Joseph coming twice, but it's his brothers coming twice to him.
Yeah, I noticed that, and I think you're right. We'll get there soon, I guess, but I think there is a Christological significance to it. It seems present in all these in all these incidents that Stephen brings up. I was struck by Alistair's comment about the way in which narratives can be cast in different light, and it seems to me that one of the ways in which the Christian story or the Bible's story is cast is that Israel had a land and things were solid and they had a possession and safety, and now in these New Testament days we are more like pilgrims and sojourners and so forth, and we don't have this permanent inheritance, as it were. But it seems to me a big thrust of Stephen's speech is to show that even Israel, even in those old times, people have always been, or God's people have always been outsiders and have always been in the minority, I guess. So Abraham goes and he is a stranger in a foreign land, and you know he has to buy the land precisely because it's not his. He doesn't have a permanent stake in it, and so he has to purchase the thing. And then Joseph finds himself in a foreign land and facing affliction and so forth, and so does Moses. And while I guess it might be nice to think of Israel as having this settled, fixed possession, it seems to me Stephen is wanting to say that those who've been faithful to God have always been in the minority and have always found themselves in a very fragile position, at least in human terms, and yet have thrived in those difficult situations. And so we get this slightly unusual detail in verse 29 here. At this retort, Moses fled and became an exile in the land of Midian, where he became the father of two sons. You might think, why is that relevant? Well, there in Midian, he's in exile. He takes a Gentile bride, and he is fruitful there. And you could say a similar thing about Daniel. And so you get this sense that God's people have always flourished as they've been cast out, which chapter 7 is going to be another example of exactly that thing.
I think that's right. And if you notice throughout the speech, Stephen rehearses how the people of God are back and forth into the land and out of the land. And it's not just that they flourish out of the land. He seems to emphasize that God's presence was with the fathers wherever they sojourned. And wherever God was present with them was holy ground. So Moses in the desert of Sinai, visited by an angel, making the ground around the burning bush holy land, we're told in verse 33. So the God of glory appears to Abraham in Mesopotamia and to Joseph in Egypt. And all of that is to show that God's presence is with his people, and it cannot be confined to one holy place or even one holy land or one holy city. And at the end, of course, he's going to challenge the absolute centrality of the temple as the locus of God's presence. Mm-hmm. And I think what this does, I don't know if Stephen had this intention, but I think Luke has this intention in including this long speech here, is it gives the Christian church a rationale for their dispersion and their flight from Jerusalem, and the fact that God is going to be with them like he was with Abraham, Joseph, Moses, even though they're no longer in the holy city anymore. Hmm.
That observation about back and forthing of yours, Jeff, I think is helpful because, as I think we've noted before, the dispersion from Jerusalem outwards isn't just a simple, right, everyone abandons Jerusalem and it's now going to the ends of the earth. But there is this back and forth thing. And so in Acts 15, for instance, or before then in Acts 11, people will return to Jerusalem and to the council and to discuss before they're then dispersed. So this is a sort of something in phases rather than just a one-off exile.
I also find it interesting, the way that the story is told is one that brings out details that aren't actually in the original account. There's very clear joining of the dots between different details that we find in scripture. So, for instance, we're not told in the Midian part of Moses' story that he had two sons there. That comes later on in chapter 18, when the two sons are brought to him with Jethro and Zipporah. And if we were told about someone having two sons in a time of being away from his home, we'd probably think more of Joseph. Joseph is the one who has Ephraim and Manasseh, and those are signs of him flourishing in the land of Egypt, forgetting the trouble of his father's house. So it seems to me that also having details like the 40 years until Moses goes out and leaves for Midian, those sorts of details aren't given on the surface of the original account. There's a suggestion of very deep reflection upon the text, the connections between things, the symmetries between characters. And I think in that respect, an example for us, how we should be reading these texts, not just seeing them as the surface to look at, but thinking about some of the deeper dots that we could be joining up.
We can summarize what Jeff and James were pointing out in the exhortation of Hebrews, where exhorts us to go outside the camp. Jesus suffered outside the gate. Stephen's going to suffer outside the gate. The holy place is no longer central city, but it's on the margins and even outside the city. So it's an eccentric location to meet with God, to find him, to commune with Jesus. And we have that dynamic being enacted in the martyrdom of Stephen. And as James and Jeff were pointing out, it's something that Stephen is also talking about as he describes the history of Israel. He's in continuity with the history of Israel as well as Jesus.
Thank you again for enjoying this episode of the Theopolis Podcast. For more information and for more content from Theopolis, you can check us out online at theopolisinstitute.com. We release new articles every Tuesday and Thursday on our blog, so you'll want to make sure to look out for those. You can also find us on Twitter at @_Theopolis. And on Facebook, if you just search for our name. If you've been helped, sharpened, and encouraged by this podcast, we'd really love it if you would go to iTunes and leave us a review. It just takes a few seconds, and it really will help us along in getting our content in front of new listeners. That's all for now, friends. We really look forward to being with you all again in the next episode. And as always, thank you so much for listening.